All right, John chapter 13, verses 34 through 35 is the text for today. And I will be referring to different parts of what is called the Upper Room Discourse that's recorded, and starting with John chapter 13, but it goes as far as John chapter 17. So go ahead and just leave your Bible open after this. But it's based on this text. It says, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." Amen. All right, so we are doing a series, a long series, as we said, talking about our values, those things that we as a church aspire to have define us. And we have said that in some ways, they're descriptive. In some ways, it's already part of who we are, but at the same time, they are aspirational. These are things, we're not there. We're not God-centered in all of our activities. We admit to that and acknowledge that we're far from it as a church, as individuals. We're not there as a church in terms of our Christ exaltation. But these are things that we want to aspire to, just as much as there are things in our lives that define us, and yet at the same time, we're not there yet, but they do define us, and they do guide us, and they do move us. One of the ways in which we can think about this series is to imagine your spouse or close friend describing you. Someone can describe you in terms of your height, your weight, your hair color, what you do to fill your schedule, and maybe even some broad personality characteristics that you might check off, like nice, friendly, punctual. But ultimately, they haven't really said very much. They haven't said much more than what would be recorded on at the DMV, right? But a person who really knows you and loves you would describe you in terms of your loves, your passions, your aspirations, what brings you delight, what makes you sad, and those things that drive you day to day and in your life, right? This is a conversation that we want to have about our church, about our church, Cross. Who are we? We know what we are. We know where we meet. We know how many people come and gather on an average Sunday. We know our activities, the list of activities, the things that we do, but those are the things that, you know, anybody can find out without a whole lot of research. But we want to have a deeper conversation about who are we as a church. We want to have a deeper conversation about that. And it is a conversation. We call it a conversation. I'm calling it a conversation because this is our church. There will be interaction. And one of the things that we want to have, starting probably next week, is a interactive dialogue. Maybe not so much because it would be, it's always awkward. We always ask, you know, Young just did this thing of, are there people with any sort of announcements that you would like to share? And some of you actually do, I bet. Some of you actually do. You started a new job or you started, you know, you got some really important questions, but you just feel like it's a little bit awkward to share it in this setting sometimes. You're not used to it. So one of the ways that we want to ease our church into it is through things like comments that you can leave, Facebook discussions, a little microblogging that we want to do. We want to have an interactive dialogue, a conversation about where you think we are, where we are, where you are, and part of this process as well, where you are in terms of your commitments as well to these things. Now, the conversation that Pastor Sam and I and some of the leaders that we have had we have settled on in terms of how we have the conversation center around which we have settled on are these 4+1 things that we've been talking about, and we'll actually go through them again really quickly for the last 4 weeks, that as a church we want to pursue being and becoming a God-centered church. That as a church, we want to pursue being and becoming a Christ-exalting church. That as a church, we want to be and become a Spirit-empowered church and become a life transforming church. That we don't want to settle until there is life transformation, and we want to tie all of these things together as a sort of a practical declaration of our church's mission. We want to be living out the mission of God in our neighborhood. So these are the things that we've been talking about. And for the last 3 weeks, we talked about what it means to be God-centered, or at least some of the ways in which we want to pursue being God-centered at our church. Not exhaustively, but definitely, because, you know, God-centered, gosh, that is the entirety of our existence, right? We could preach, we could meet at church every day for the rest of our lives and still not find exhaustive ways of thinking about what it means to be God-centered, but we want to just limit it for obvious practical reasons to three, and we want to do that now, starting this week, with Christ-exalting, what it means to be Christ-exalting. So one of the things that we want to do with this series is when someone asks us, what is Cross about? What is your church about? We want to be able to say we're God-centered, Christ-exalting, and Spirit-empowered, and life-transforming, and know what that means. Not just have it to be a bunch of words that we happen to repeat, but know what that means. So today we're going to start talking about Christ-exalting, what it means to be Christ-exalting, and I want to focus on this subject, this topic of Christ-exalting fellowship. So in Christ-exalting, we want to talk about what are the things, you can think about it in terms of these questions. What brings you delight? This is going to be one of the things that we'll be talking about, especially when it comes to joy, Christ-exalting joy that Pastor Sam will preach on next week. What brings us delight? What brings you delight? When Christ is exalted in your life, or when you are exalted in your life? What do you find yourself striving after? Where do you find yourself focusing all of your energy toward? For Christ to be praised, or for you to be praised? All right? Because in practice, the opposite. We think the opposite of Christ's exaltation sometimes is something like Christ's degradation, right? That would be the opposite. That would be the antonym. Is that, well, I don't do that. Therefore, I must be okay. But in practice, the opposite, the real practical antonym of Christ's exaltation is not that as much as self-exaltation. When we become so focused on how we are receiving praise, when we become so overly focused on how we are doing in terms of, getting recognition. So that's what the issue of Christ's exaltation, Christ's exalting life is about. Now, again, Christ's exalting, we could spend an entire year or longer easily talking about what it means to be exalting, but we want to focus on fellowship today, and we're going to focus on three things for part of this series. I'm going to talk about Christ exalting in our fellowship. And we want to talk about a fellowship. We want to talk about love among the followers of God, love among disciples that points to Christ, that exalts Christ, that points others to see Christ. Because that's what Jesus says here. He says, by your love for one another, you will know that you are my disciples. Now, I want to do this a little bit of a roundabout way. How many of you guys enjoy going to museums, specifically like looking at paintings and artwork? How many people here? Okay. Anybody like, you look at Renaissance or medieval art specifically? Anybody, you guys kind of familiar with it a little bit? You guys enjoy that? Okay. Everybody knows generically what you've seen medieval and Renaissance art. Now, what is the predominant theme, the subject of these paintings and sculptures? What would you say? People? Okay. Too broad. Too broad. what sorts of people? So yeah, portraits, right? It's true. You got Mona Lisa, you got Michelangelo's David, the sculpture, you got history. Sometimes you'll see a a painting of the siege of this some French town somewhere. You'll even have classical myths, but predominantly they are what? Medieval art, Bible themes, right? Would you guys, now, yes? Or you guys are like, okay, if you say so. I say, absolutely, it is Bible themes. Renaissance as well. Anybody know why that's the case? Because people were just going, oh man, what am I going to paint today? Might as well just paint a Bible theme. No, that's not the case. Is it just because the influence of church was at its highest at that time? No, it's not. It is actually a very specific and concrete reason. The reason why there's so many Bible themes is not just because these things were, the people were afraid that if they painted anything else, they would get persecuted or something like that by the church, by the Inquisition or something like that. But it's because they were meant to be teaching tools. These paintings of the medieval artists, of the Renaissance artists as well, they were commissioned by the church to be teaching tools. Now think about, why would these paintings be teaching tools? Because you go back to a time in which about 10 to 15% of the population read anything. This was before the printing, the great revolution of the printing press. This was about 10 to 15% literacy rate. So the way in which people saw and came to Christ, the way in which people learned the messages of the gospel were actually a lot through these paintings. So that's why these paintings and these sculptures were so important. And these were masters at it. They would tell entire stories, these frozen pictures in time, and yet they would tell entire stories by the expressions and motions and activities that were going on. It was amazing, amazing things, right? They would learn, people would learn about who God is by looking at these paintings. Now, fast forward in history to our times. In our time, what would you say is the primary mode by which we think people learn the truths of our faith, the truths about God? What would most people say? Paintings still? No, the way in which people nowadays would be words, right? Words. We do Bible study, we come to church, we listen to someone speak. I don't act out a scene for you. I don't paint for you. I don't do a whole bunch of, you know, interpretive dance. I don't do that. Some of you would love for me to do that. No, some of you would love for me not to do that. Classical evangelism that you grew up learning, what is evangelism? That was about learning what to say, right? We take it for granted, but there are different ways in which we say that the truths of the gospel is meant to be conveyed. And there is nothing wrong with words. Otherwise, I would stop talking, right? But at least in this one occasion, Jesus doesn't point to a painting or sculpture. Jesus doesn't speak, he's not talking about words. He's not pointing to words. He's not pointing to what to say. Righteous words as a way of revealing our faith. But at least in this one occasion, this last occasion, Jesus says, the world looks upon your fellowship. The world will look upon how you love one another as the means of seeing the way of Christ, the way of faith, of journeying with me. Our love for one another as fellow followers in faith. Try saying that like 10 times. That's supposed to exalt Christ. A new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. Now, the reality, of course, is that more often than not, Christian fellowship fails to reveal the love of God unto humanity. And I don't think this is because we have such bad fellowship. I don't think this is because Christians are really mean and nasty to each other. I mean, there are stories of that, but I don't think that's the main reason. But I think it happens more often because we don't consider the importance that Christ is placing on this. We don't quite fully appreciate what Jesus is saying. How we maintain a love for one another, relationships at church, most people rarely think it as central to our worship. And Jesus says, by this all men will see that you are my followers and see the love of God as I have loved you and as the Father has loved me. That love people will see through your fellowship. Compare, listen to what Jesus says here. How central he makes our love for one another as a way in which Christ's love is understood in the world. And now think how odd it seems to hear when somebody says something like this. We hear it often enough. I probably said it sometime in my lifetime as well. When somebody says something like, I attended this big gathering, this big worship, and it was just me and God. And it was worship at its purest. Right? Do you see how one thing completely has almost no use for fellowship, and the other thing that Jesus says this is how people are going to see God's love? I am not saying that God cannot meet you in large gatherings or meet you directly, but I do want for us to see how little value, how incongruous this is, and how much Jesus values this thing called fellowship. There are three things that I want to point out in this passage that to help us better understand the sort of love that exalts Christ in our fellowship. Love for one another as disciples. I want to talk about the nature of this fellowship love, and the second thing I want to talk about is the expectation that is given in this fellowship love, and the third thing I want to talk about is the mission, the purpose, the direction of this love. Now, the first thing I want to talk about is the nature of this love and fellowship. It's not just a fact of our love, but Jesus points also to the nature of our love. Look at my observation. When we look at this passage, when we hear Jesus say, and this is a very famous passage that gets paraphrased quite often, says they will know us by our love, right? That we ought to love one another. I hear it like this often. I hear it kind of like when I tell my kids, or when you tell your kids, is that, you know, you need to love one another. You need to basically stop fighting and you need to behave. You need to get together and love each other because it's giving me a bad name. People are going to look at you and people are going to look at me and say, what sort of a parent is that? Those kids are fighting all the time. And we see this a little bit as what Jesus is doing. Look, disciples, stop fighting. Stop with all this, you know, trying to compete for who is bigger than the other person, who is more important. Stop doing that. Love one another, and they will know I am a good God. I think there's a little bit of that, and it would be a start. But it would only be a start because Jesus starts off this conversation like this. He says, a new command I give to you. A new command I give to you, he says. This is a new thing I'm saying to you. Love one another. If you think about how odd that would sound if Jesus meant just love one another, and it's a new command I'm giving you, you just go, Jesus, really, that's your original new thing that you're saying? Love one another? That's your new thing? You know, new thing would be like, you know, hey, you know, here's the latest cutting edge thing on social media, you know. Here's the latest cutting edge thing on how to love people, and this is a new thing I want you guys to do. Shake your hands like this, you know, behind your back. This is a new thing. This is not a new thing, Jesus. What are you talking about? This is a strange thing for you to start off by saying new thing, unless Jesus says this to mean not just, hey, you ought to love one another, the fact of our love, that we ought to love, more than whether or not we love, but rather to say that, hey, here is a new love, new way of loving. There's a new nature to the way in which you ought to love that I want to emphasize to you. And the nature of this love is spelled out. He emphasizes it throughout the upper room discourse. And he starts off in chapter 13, and he talks about the first thing that he does when the disciples gather, and he says he wants to reveal to them the full extent of his love. This is what Jesus says. And then what does he do? He washes their feet. He washes their feet. And they're like, what? What is this thing? And Jesus is saying, look, I'm trying to show you what you're supposed to do. He poured this water into the basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with a towel. And he says, now that I, the Lord, has washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I'm trying to show you the nature of this new love. And Jesus goes on. And then later on, and part of this conversation, in chapter 15, he says, look, let me tell you about this love for one another. My command is this, love each other. Chapter 15, verse 12, it says, love each other as I have loved you. Don't love each other as you think best fit. Okay? Jesus says, love each other as I'm teaching you, as I have loved you. Love each other with his new love, a new command I'm giving you. Greater love, and he uses this example that gets thrown around a lot, and we finally get it only later in Christ's sacrifice on the cross. Greater love has no one than this, than that he lay down his life for his friends. I can never figure out the grammar in that sentence, and all the times that I've memorized that passage. Greater love has no one than this, that he laid down his life for his friends. Of course, in chapter 18 and on, he gets his procession to the cross that demonstrates his love completely and fullest. What's the point of this? The point of this is that the love that Jesus is commanding us for us to love each other with is not just to say, hey, love one another. Be nice to one another. Love each other because you already know how. Jesus said, no. You actually don't, because our love, for the most part, is extremely selfish. Have you guys ever noticed that about yourselves? In moments of real clarity and honesty about the way in which you love, you realize how selfish you can be about your love for others as well, right? I got three people acknowledging yes, and everybody else is going, yeah, that's just you, buddy. I'm with the three people. And this is the essential character of God, and this is the longest of my three points because, of course, it's the first point. And it's this, that fundamentally, that God is not a demander, but he is a giver. He moves us. He beckons us. He calls us. All of these things he does through his first step of love toward us. And love is first an act of gift and giving. That's why grace is such an important understanding. Once you understand that, you realize how just the entire Bible is all about the God of grace, because it is about God who acts first to love us. Fundamentally, God is not a demander. This is not God who comes to us and say, you must exalt me. Christ exalting is not about Christ saying, exalt me, ha, ha, ha. But rather, this is Christ saying, I am going to love you in such a way That the only possible, imaginable, and appropriate response is to fall down in just exaltation. Because God has gifted us. Because the only right response to great generosity, look, the only logical, reasonable, normal response, and we all know this, to great generosity is gratitude. And secondly, a gratitude that begets generosity unto others, right? It makes no sense, right? It makes no sense, the story that Jesus tells of a guy who basically is forgiven millions and millions of dollars. Jesus tells this parable about a guy who is forgiven a debt of millions and millions of dollars. And he would have been thrown away in debtor's prison in Australia somewhere for the rest of his life. But instead, he is forgiven that. But then what does he do? He goes up to somebody a little bit smaller than him. And I can pick up, you know, you owe me $5. And I have proof. That story Jesus tells, he says, look, that's a ridiculous story. It doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen like that. When you get forgiven and you understand how much you've been forgiven, you go and you say, $5? Forget it. Forget it. Forget it. Come over to my house for dinner. This is the best day of my life. I'll buy you coffee. I'll buy everyone coffee. I'm so happy. That's the normal response. This is what Jesus is saying. Generosity, God's generosity begets generosity in our midst. God's nature is to give. So our fellowship then must be punctuated by giving as well. That means our fellowship is defined by God's giving. Such generosity and such desire to serve others. That's the first thing. Second thing I want to say, this is point 1B. It's a quick one. Listen, if you're a Christian and if you are here, if you're here at church, or if you're at church anywhere, if you're a Christian and you go to church, fundamentally, you must understand that you're not at church fundamentally to get something. Okay? Why? Because you're at church because not to get something, but because you have already received something. Right? That should be a fundamental understanding of why we come to church. And I think somewhere along the way, we get this confused with all of the consumerism of our times, that we think about church as a place primarily, I'm not saying that you don't ever get something. I'm here to try to give you something right now, and you might not like it. But, you know, I'm here to try to give you something, but fundamentally, we're not gathering at church to get something. We're gathering at church because we have already been given so much. And we're here then to give to others as well. Right? Does that make sense? I think our default mode is this. Sometimes. I think our default mode sometimes is to come to church, come to fellowship thinking, I am here to get something. I think our default mode sometimes is to go to small groups. I think our default mode is sometimes to go to prayer groups, church, fellowship time, whatever gathering, and say, what am I going to get? And sometimes you'll feel like, I don't need to get anything, so therefore I'm not going to go. Or I don't really feel like I'm going to get anything from them, so I'm not going to go. Here's the problem with that. Being a Christian means that we are people who say we have already received the greatest possible gift possible. Greatest possible gift. It isn't that there won't be any benefits of fellowship. There are plenty, but it is a wrong assumption that will kill future relationships when we think the fundamental dynamic of coming to church is to get something rather than as people who have already been gifted so much. What would it look like in our church? What would it look like in our church fellowship if we as a church said, we want to really live this out and we want to help one another live this out? Imagine a church fellowship time if we were all just, if the default dynamic of our church was to say, what can I give to someone? How can I give? We would be very generous, I think, in our spirit. I think we would be very generous in our attitude toward one another. I think we would be very generous in our approach toward relationships and how we understand one another and how we think about each other's flaws. Every time I talk about generosity of spirit, Pastor Sam likes to rephrase that as largesse of the heart. And it's always a word that Young likes to make fun of. Pastor Jin likes to talk about largesse a lot. And it's this grandness in our heart that leaves room for flaws in others. This is exactly what Jesus had. Exactly what Jesus had. One very practical way that I think we can start as a discipline transforming our understanding of fellowship is we often go home or we often go to church events or activities and assess our experience like this. We say, what did I get? What if instead we started asking, what did I give? Would our fellowship look different? What did I give? To ask that question also requires a preparation, right? Because it requires preparation to give. The reason you attend fellowships, small groups, isn't so much then, will I get anything? Do I need this? But rather because you say, how can I give to someone? How can I think about somebody to give something to? And I want to challenge all of us to think about a fellowship like this. What can I give? Because I think that's what Jesus is asking for us to do. He says, a new command I give to you. The second thing that I want to talk about is the expectation. The first thing was the nature of this love, and the nature of this love is based on God's generosity. And the nature of this love is me giving as the primary dynamic. But the second thing I want to talk to you about is the expectation of this love, and there is an expectation. We love by its very nature does not demand, right? You know, you always see these like movies in which the tyrant or the villain says something like, you must love me. And you just go, how pathetic, how sad, right? But it's incongruous, you know, to say you must and demand love from someone. But love does place an expectation of response on the beloved. One has to either accept that love by loving back in kind or reject that love, right? Love is fulfilled. Love is made complete by a mutuality. Beloved becomes the lover as well. Unrequited love, like for some reason the only example of a movie in which there's unrequited love that I could think of was Jacob, the wolf boy in Twilight series. If it goes on, it's not no longer love. Everybody knows this. Come on, you guys all love those movies. Just blame it on the teens. You know, there are always these romantic stories, and maybe some of you guys have these romantic stories as well, of someone who pursues love, even though there was rejection initially. How many of you guys would say that your relationship started out that way? There was rejection initially. You could even say, I'm the one who rejected the other person if you want to feel more powerful. But how many of you would say that that's kind of like how it happened? And, you know, you hear these stories. But you can't say, even if you don't ever love me, even if you reject me forever, I will love you. That's called stalking. And that's right? And even at divine level, as much as we would love to think of God as some sort of a divine stalker, he doesn't do that. Right? Don't worry so much about how this fits into Reformed theology and all that stuff, but God says throughout the Bible in many different ways, I will reject you as you have rejected me. Ultimately, God is willing to say that. Love always begins from a direction, but it is not right for that love to remain one direction, one directional. So Jesus talks about love, not like this, not a new command I give to you, love people. A new command, as I have loved you, so you must also love others. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples if you love. Jesus does not say that. Right? What does he say instead? What's the phrase that I left out? Love one another. Love one another. Love one another. As I have washed your feet, Jesus says, wash one another's feet. Jesus doesn't say, just wash forever. It doesn't mean that it happens immediately and say, hey, this is the deal. I am going to love you, but you're going to love me, okay? That's not the demand that we're talking about. That's not love. That's a transaction, right? But if I say, hey, I'm going to love you as a brother, as a, you know, I'm going to love you. And I show him love. And there's an expectation of response. There's a mutuality that happens in love. And this mutuality also creates a certain a culture and a dynamic of equality in the sense of you are now, there's nobody who just gives love. Now, if you're going to be part of a fellowship, you must also receive love. How many people have ever participated in a foot washing ceremony? Okay, many of you. Okay, wow. What is harder, to wash someone's foot or to have your feet washed? To have your feet washed. And it's not just because you're going, oh, my feet are stinky. No, it's just going, my toenails, okay? It's not just that. It's just to receive somebody else is humble, to have somebody else come before you and kneel before you and to serve you like that. It's really, really hard. It goes against nearly everything that our society says about what it means to be a successful, strong person. Let me pay you to wash my feet. I will feel okay with that. But you just washing my feet out of your love for me, that is really, really hard. Right? The default, I think, is to think that in our fellowship, the response to one another, this relationship that gets created, is optional. That we can stay disconnected. But it takes spiritual maturity to respond in love as well. To give, but also to receive. To really receive, because to receive like that requires an openness. And I think this is something that's really, really hard for us, and it's going to take a lot of discipline. Esther knows one of the things that I've been trying to work out in terms of how I think about things. I realize that a lot of people, including myself, a lot of people, though, struggle with this, and especially in receiving love, I think one of the issues is we fail to understand what is the difference between private and what is personal. Okay? There is private stuff in our lives in which we say, look, it's just private information. We don't necessarily need to divulge that to our small groups or even to our friends or even to, there's just private stuff, you know? You don't need to know my medical history, this or some things even in the past that I've completely moved away from if that has no hold on me. And even sins, there's some private stuff that you can actually leave in the past. Okay? You can actually do that. But we mistake that with personal. Stuff that requires for us to be vulnerable, but that we really, really need somebody else to hear us out, to perhaps even forgive us, to guide us, to love us and care for us, because we cannot deal with this stuff by ourselves. And we fail to understand the difference between these two things, that there is private stuff, and there are very few things actually that I think are really, really private. But most people would like to say, hey, I'm in fellowship, and I've actually shared with you as much as I want. And we leave anything that requires any sort of openness, and we think that's all private stuff, stuff that I don't have to share. Is it, you know, what happens is if you don't share anything, eventually nobody will get to know you. They will get to know the superficial DMV information about you. And eventually in fellowship, that's when you start to feel lonely and isolated, even in a crowd. Right? So I think that's one of the things that we really need to understand. How to be open to others so that others might respond perhaps even to your kindness, that others might think of you as an opportunity to extend God's grace. The mutuality that must exist in a healthy relationship and a healthy fellowship. And the third thing that I want to talk about really quickly, because we're going to go into communion time today, and really, you know, the communion, and it's not by accident that the words can be synonyms, right? So I'm going to leave the communion to, in some ways, to really complete this message. But the third part of this love is that there is a mission. The first is that there's a nature to this love that we need to understand. That there, second is that we need to understand that there's an expectation to this love. And the third thing is that we need to understand that there's a mission to this love. Our fellowship must always be inviting. It must always be open to others. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. Why does Jesus say this? Because he is self-conscious and he cares about what people think about him? All people will know. I want for people to know I'm a good guy. No, he's not doing this. He wants to do this. He wants you to understand. He wants for us to understand that our love serves to extend the mission of God, the grace of God unto others. A natural tendency, the default tendency in our understanding of how to do fellowship is actually to exclude. It really is. Just naturally, we fall into a mode of kind of excluding people who are different from us. It's even without consciously saying that we're going to do this. A long time ago, I gave a sermon illustration in which I actually asked Nadia to come up to the front. And Nadia, I don't know if you remember this. And I asked a bunch of guys. And I asked a bunch of guys to come on up, you know, five or six guys to kind of just say, hey, I want you guys to circle up. And the guys circled up. I said, I want to ask Nadia, I'm going to give Nadia a mission, which was to just join that circle. Okay? That's how I left it. I wanted for the guys to circle up, and for Nadia, her mission too. You guys remember this now? That was it. Two instructions, circle up, and Nadia joined that circle. And what happened? Nadia tried to get in, and the guys just, locked up, and they tightened up. They even locked arms at certain points, and they just kind of just pushed Nadia out with their butt. And Nadia was just like trying to, it was just a really hilarious sight. It was really lots of physical comedy. And here's the thing. I never, ever instructed those guys, right, to not let Nadia in. And you could use that example, illustration, anywhere. And that's always what's going to happen. And I think that's actually a good illustration of what happens when we gather together. Just simply out of our familiarity, simply because we say, well, we give all sorts of excuses for why we might exclude. We don't do it because we're trying to be mean. We don't do it because we're trying to be uncivil. We do it simply because it is so much easier for us to exclude. But a mission of love, the tendency must be broken. And Jesus says, look, this new love must extend out. We need to break down the attitude that says fellowship is about us because it's about God. Because of that, and because it is about God, because it is the love of God, it must be about others. So fellowship must always have a hospitality element to it. An important, essential element of Christian fellowship must be hospitality. And you've seen this, witnessed this as well in your lives when our fellowship works. The mission of our fellowship must be remembered. That there's a point, and it's not just to build friendships amongst ourselves. That's important. But the point is to exalt Christ with our fellowship. I want to invite Pastor Sam to lead us in a time of communion.